to turn this bitch sideways. I can't believe that it's Freaky Friday. It's Freaky Friday. I'm in Chris Brown's body. I drive his Ferrari and I'm like skin black.
I woke up and I'm Lil Dicky.
Lil Dicky?
This is real weak. How is this staying perched upon his
car? All right, some explanation may be necessary. Some explanation will be necessary. Much explanation will be necessary. All right, so let me begin explaining. First of all, we're in New Haven today. We're in this first time I've ever used these new Gateway Community College studios. We are doing The Nose, which is our weekly cultural roundtable. The song that you just heard is going to be part of our first conversation. It is a gift given to us by the artists Lil Dicky and Chris Brown. A little bit later in the show, we will talk about the recrudescence, with the emphasis on the crude syllable, no, not really, of Roseanne, the TV show, and the way in which it has kind of touched off a very interesting national conversation about who does and doesn't get represented on television, who we need to be looking at. And then lastly, we've gone to see The Death of Stalin. It is directed by Armando Iannucci, he of In the Loop and most notoriously Veep. It is sometimes referred to as a comedy of terrors. It is both dark, as the Stalin era should be, and also a comedy in which various underlings, feeling more or less empowered, struggle with one another, curse one another out, vie for contention. I don't know if this is starting to sound familiar to you at all, given the. It's sort of weird how The Death of Stalin kind of. I mean, it looks like the current White House, but it looks like so many other things as well. Anyway, it's all awash in music that is either Shostakovich and Prokofiev or something that sounds like that. It's a lot of fun. At least I thought so. Anyway, let me tell you who's here. Lucy Gelman is editor of The Arts Paper and host of WNHH's Radio's, Kitchen Sink, S-I-N-C. Mercy Quay is founder and executive director of The Narrative Project. Brian Slattery is arts editor of the New Haven Independent and a producer at WNHH Radio. So why are we starting off with this song? Partly because it's going to be, I think, something of a hit. It is debuting at number 9 on the Billboard Hot 100. Here at Public Radio, we pay a lot of attention to what's on the Billboard Hot 100. but also because it does a Freaky Friday transposition. The notion is that Lil Dicky. Mercy, how would we describe Lil Dicky?
He is a cool Jewish rapper. That's what I got for you.
All right.
Cool. But kind of dorky, but like that's what's cool about him.
Right. So, yeah, cool in a very dorky way. The premise is that there is a Freaky Friday style transposition so that he wakes up. You heard, may have heard him say that he woke up in Chris Brown's body. You may have heard him, except that obviously that has to be Chris Brown who's singing that. So, complicated. There's a fair amount of rapping and singing about who's what it's like to be which race. It's catchy, as you probably heard. There's like a separate conversation. Maybe I'll save this for like the second half of this about whether it makes any sense at all to like or pay attention to Chris Brown.
Yeah.
But maybe let's, before we close that, I mean, I'm intending to close that door personally before anybody closes any door. Let's actually talk about the song itself. And Mercy, you were the one who really called it to our attention.
Yeah.
Why do we want to talk about it?
Because for the first time since the Chris Brown Rihanna situation, I am now paying attention to Chris Brown, and it is regretfully so. But right, like I'm here, and I want to talk about it with you guys, right? The way I came about it was actually I every now and again I kind of venture onto Chris Brown's Instagram. Just, you know, as a hate fan. And he had the clip of I drive this Ferrari and I'm light skinned black. And I was like, what is this? What is he talking about? And so I went and looked it up, and then I discovered Lil Dicky was a thing. I liked it. And because Chris Brown is such an awful human being, I think the standard for what would make me like him is I don't even know. It's so low, right? Like it's so low since he is an awful human being. And when I saw this, and I was just like, well, you're sort of incorporating Freaky Friday here. There's awful tropes throughout the entire song, and I have to suspend any type of morality that I have to watch it, the video especially. But it's fun. It's kind of fun. And it's a feel-good summer song, too. Mm. Anyone else feel the same way?
Well, I don't envy you having to defend Chris Brown right now.
We'll circle back to that. But so, Lucy, one of the things the song is kind of scraping its thumbnail against is something that we've seen in the past before, which is that each side of any subculture or dominant culture and subculture, they're a little bit intrigued about what goes along with being the other thing.
Yes.
You can think about a Bryan Cranston as Jerry Seinfeld's dentist who wants to be able to tell the Jew jokes, but he's not Jewish. So he converts so that he can tell the Jew jokes. I think in the very first episode, the very first season of Atlanta, there was a white DJ who came over and kind of used the N-word with Donald Glover and got kind of a look from him. And then the next time he told the same story to more black people, he dropped that word out. He told the story identically, but dropped that word out because he's experimenting with whether he can say that word, and he can't. So I think that that's what this thing is kind of, that's the knife's edge that this song runs its thumb down.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I, Mercy, I share a lot of feelings with you because
Are you as conflicted as I am?
I am as conflicted as you are because I saw it and I was like, oh, this is funky. This is weird. I'm someone who really liked Flight of the Conchords, which I don't think is totally, totally different.
It's not. You're right.
But do you think was totally before its time? Mm-hmm. And so I saw this and I was like, they're kind of doing the same thing. But Colin, you're absolutely right. It's this discussion of what can I say? What can I say? And we've seen some songs come out. I'm forgetting the title of it, but it's something like I'm Not Racist or Tell Me I'm Racist. So it's a song with a black guy on one side of the table and a white guy on one side of the table. And they're transposed. And it was going around sort of social media a couple weeks ago. And I think there's still that conversation of what can I say, what can't I say? Mm-hmm. In New Haven, we're seeing that very much right now, or we did see it a couple of weeks ago with Eric Triffin, a professor at Southern Connecticut State University, and the question of when is it okay or is it ever okay? And I would say no for a white person to use the N-word in conversation.
I mean, I have that same conflict. We saw it 5 minutes ago when you guys were talking about Seder and you said Jew. And I was like, can I say Jew? Ira Glass had this conversation. Alex, I still don't know if I can say Jew.
Right. He has a shtick where he stands and he says, like, you look at me and you see tall Jew. And, you know, and I can say that, like, oh, you look at me and you see short Jew. Can you say that? I don't know. It gets kind of dicey.
Yeah. I always add the ish because it makes an adjective.
Yeah.
Bluish, Jewish. Yeah.
So, Brian, I don't know if you've fully weighed in yet.
Well, I think that, like, this conversation about what people can and cannot do usually comes up. It doesn't come up if the thing that you're talking about is really good. Mm. It only comes up when the thing that we're talking about is kind of okay. And it definitely comes up when it's really bad. And, you know, so for this one, the fact that we're even talking about it at all is an indication that maybe this song is just okay. I mean, this was one of those songs where I listened to it and I just thought, like, I wish this was more fun. It's like, it's a little more cheeky than actually fun. And I say this as somebody who likes really fun things, you know, and that's, you know, so I sat there going, you know, I see that you're trying to push some buttons, but, you know, they've been pushed before.
Well, so, I mean,
I'm so disappointed.
Well, everybody's allowed to. No, I agree that it is a completely catchy song.
It is.
Yeah. And you know.
It. I mean, it's also kind of like, if you think back, so I don't even know how many years ago, it's probably like 6 or 7 years ago, a lot of people were into The Lonely Island. And
oh, yeah, that's like,
super,
yeah.
Songs like I Just Had Sex that are not that interesting, actually.
Right.
But when they come out, they're really, really funny.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And they're catchy. And sort of even the use of auto-tune, I think, is meant to be funny.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's sure. Chris Brown's real voice, just throwing that out there. But also, that's also a little Dickie Stitch, right? He's a funny rapper. I think he has a song called on his album Professional Rapper. He has a song called I'm a Professional Rapper, and he's going back and forth with Snoop Dogg about, like, Snoop giving him a job, and Snoop's like reading his references. He's like, oh yeah, no, I was a business major, and I grew up in a really good neighborhood, right? That's his whole thing, that he doesn't identify with his lifestyle at all.
We should say, speaking of giving people jobs, this musical effort also features Ed Sheeran.
Yeah.
And I believe Kendall Jenner. I'm not too good at keeping these people
Somebody's
straight.
Somebody's got a really good Rolodex.
Seriously?
So, you know. But I think we have to now like put our foot on that middle rail. And that's that whole question of Chris Brown with his long history of violence towards women. Mm-hmm. There was, well, you said at the beginning, you had mostly been hate watching his Instagram feed and kind of taking maybe a permanent vacation from Chris Brown.
Yeah.
Here in an era where we, I think, delete people from our cultural radar screen for smaller offenses. Mm-hmm. There is kind of a question to me, like if Chris Brown, if it's ever going to be okay to watch a pretty much unrepentant Chris Brown too and enjoy him, I'm struggling with that. I'm struggling how that can be.
Sort of like, right. Is there a way to guilt-free watch Chris Brown?
Well, I'm just also wondering, like, I don't know, Jonathan Schwartz isn't on the radio anymore, mm-hmm. and I don't even know what he did. He, like, made people uncomfortable because he said stuff a certain way, you know? And
yeah, it's true.
Meanwhile, there are actual photos of Chris Brown choking people. Yeah.
Right. Yes. And right. I mean, yeah. So,
like last week.
People in certain areas, I mean, obviously, right. Chris Brown were hosting an NPR show, he would have been gone a long time ago. But but there are people in various walks of life who are, you know, either being boycotted or, I mean, Matt Damon was boycotted and protested because of an interview he gave about other people's stuff. That's like how easily you can get in trouble these days. And Chris Brown gets to punch people in the face and without any apparent consequences.
I have no idea how he became uninfallible. And I also don't understand how his career has survived. Right. Like in ways that other artists haven't. I mean, even Bill Cosby's career hasn't really survived his run-in with Me Too. But I mean, in the process of hate watching his Instagram, he reposts comments from his fans talking about how Chris Brown can do no wrong, and I'm just like, actually, he does a lot of wrong,
many
wrong.
Daily.
He has done.
Kind of the definition of wrong.
He redefines it for us every week.
Yeah. Lucy, I'm wondering if maybe what I'm doing, the mistake I'm making, is kind of conflating two different things, which doesn't entirely explain things. But the Me Too movement, to some degree, is about policing workplace behavior, movie set behavior, things like that, and other kinds of workplaces as well, where people are sexual harassers, where they make people's lives uncomfortable and difficult, where maybe they go a little bit farther and take their pants off and invite people to look at things, I mean, Charlie Rose coming to the door naked, nobody wants that. Whereas other people are criminals. Like when you straight beat up, somebody just, so badly that they look like Rihanna in those photos.
Right.
So, and maybe Me Too isn't really set up to deal with people who are actual criminals. Maybe, although, you know, you can say some of the Harvey Weinstein stuff and certainly the Bill Cosby stuff.
Yeah.
Those are crimes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes.
So maybe we need to kind of segregate those two different categories or something.
Oh, I mean, I want to hear Mercy's take as well. Even within that, it's complicated because as I was watching this video, it was sort of like, oh, haha, this is funny. But then the creepy crawlies come out and they start, creepy crawling all over your body because you feel gross about watching this and maybe even having a chuckle or two chuckles at it. You know, as far as the question of, like, do we need to separate out those two movements? Mm. I think we're still figuring out Me Too. Like, I think we are so in Me Too right now that we're still figuring it out. I've heard really interesting discussions on one end. Has Me Too gone too far? Is there sort of hypersensitivity to it? On totally other end of the spectrum, do we need to go even further because of microaggressions in the workplace? And so I do think we're still figuring that out. As far as whether or not we should feel okay about watching artwork produced by people who really are perpetrating violent mm-hmm. crimes, mm-hmm. I think, it's okay to feel gross. And I would hope, actually, that someone would feel maybe a little bit gross and reckon with this a little bit, as opposed to just saying, I'm enjoying this. I'm going to roll with it.
We have to go to the Slattery standard. Are you able to express? I thought your Slattery standard was really good.
So for what it's worth, like my sort of the way I've been sort of, you know, sorting through all of this is that I have this idea that the art needs to be better than the artist isn't good. And if that's true, then I'm kind of okay with it. This hasn't been seriously tested. I should say, like, there. I mean, I have my idols.
It's a beta theory. It's a beta theory.
Yeah, very much.
We're rolling
so.
It
like,
out right
you know,
now.
I have my sort of artistic idols, and if I learned that they were like truly horrible human beings, I would be pretty.
Yeah, that's what in the email. For example, you said, like, what would it take?
Prince.
Yeah, what would happen about D'Angelo or Prince?
Right.
Yeah,
if I learned that D'Angelo was like a serial rapist, I would have some real soul searching to do.
But I also,
thankfully,
may
I don't
not
think
be
that's
surprised.
Actually the case.
Giving up Chris Brown is a cheap date with your conscience.
That's right. I don't mind giving up Chris Brown. You know, like that was an easy one to get rid of. Like I don't think that this song is better than Chris Brown is bad.
Yeah. No. I think that's a fine standard. I think for me it's kind of it's nostalgic for a time when Chris Brown was innocent.
For what it's worth, I mean, I'm someone who at one point gleefully sang an R. Kelly song in public, which I regret now. So that standard has changed.
I'm
an evolving human.
At that
being.
Moment, you believed you could fly.
It was a different song.
Oh, right.
So, but there are also like moments in there are also moments in the video that like I struggle with. Right. So a few months ago, maybe a year ago at this point, Chris Brown had a run-in where the cops were surrounding his home because he was holding someone hostage at gunpoint. And in this video, Lil Dicky in Chris Brown's body pulls out a gun and is like juggling it and puts it back into its box. And I'm just like, that seems like a poor ref, right? None of this feels comfortable to me, and I don't want to laugh at any of it.
If Chris Brown took any of that stuff seriously, it would be.
Right.
All right. So I think we have a clean segue, sort of, to the other topic in this segment, and that is the rebuilding of Roseanne, which resulted in 18 million people watching this week. That, in this day and age, is a very, very large audience. This, as you know, is a resurrection of the fabled Connor family of the 90s. And it reunites most of them. Most of them are just sort of aged into their new roles, although, as Roxane Gay pointed out, they don't really age the way poor people age. They age the way people who have access to Hollywood stylists and really good medical care age. But anyway, they've aged in their – and there are new elements. There is a new young character with gender presentation issues, as we say in New Haven. There is a child who is either – they're fully black or half black. I don't think that's really kind of been spelled out yet. But the other thing it has is a new fan. And that fan, for good or ill, would be the president of the United States.
Mm-hmm. Even look at Roseanne. I called her yesterday. Look at her ratings. Look at her ratings. I got a call from Mark Burnett. He did The Apprentice. He's a great guy. He said, Donald, I called just to say hello and to tell you, did you see Roseanne's ratings? I said, Mark, how big were they? They were unbelievable. Over 18 million people. And it was about us. They haven't figured it out. The fake news hasn't quite figured it out yet. They have not figured it out. So that was great. And they haven't figured it out. But they will. And when they do, they'll become much less fake. May take a while, but it's happening.
Our ratings obsessed chief of state. All right, so Lucy Gelman, I always forget that you grew up in the Rust Belt.
I did.
And so in a way, for those of us in the East Coast cognoscenti, Roseanne maybe reverberates a different way, but I don't know. What do you make about what's happening right now, and how do you link it to whatever Roseanne was to you back in the day?
What's happening right now? Do you mean this current political storm moment that we're in?
And I mean, maybe I'll just go further. Just as you were saying about Me Too a few seconds ago, I don't think we really know what this particular Roseanne moment is.
No.
I mean, this is an attempt by the Roseanne Show to present an America that kind of checks a series of boxes of sort of problematic things. You know, I mean, it's not simply the representation, notwithstanding what the president said. It's not, well, this is us. Well, it's us, but it's also some other people who aren't Donald Trump's version, emphatically aren't Donald Trump's version of us. And the question is, how are these white working class people going to deal with all these new arrivals? And we don't know that yet.
We don't. I think you're getting to two different things, one of which you've talked before, which is that there's always nostalgia in the background, mm-hmm. Especially with popular culture. And I think this show is fed largely by nostalgia. But it's also fed by a sentiment, I think. And so I think Roseanne has always been a show that is populist but not partisan. And by that, I mean, she's someone who, like, and we know from interviews that have come out around the reboot of the show, we know that she is now a Trump supporter. But when you watch the show, you kind of see someone who's on the fray a little bit, but who could go for Trump or who could go for Bernie, who's into an outsider, who feels very disconnected from what's going on sort of on the East Coast and the West Coast and the American coast. And I think there is an interest, whether or not it's misguided, I don't know, in the TV networks and then more broadly, even in the media. You know, if you look at the New York Times, I think they hired relatively recently a religion reporter to go around the country and talk to people about religion. Mm-hmm. It was something like people reporter or a community reporter to go into communities around the country and talk to people. So I think that network television is also responding to the fact that, like, a lot of folks got something horribly wrong or misjudged something by a huge margin, and we're seeing an attempt to bring folks into a popular conversation and onto television, in this case again, who maybe aren't always represented. But I also want to say Roseanne originally was a show of first. There were a lot of lesbian characters on the show. And this was before, you know, The L Word came out in 2004. Mm-hmm. This was in the 1990s. I think it was one of the first gay kisses on network television. And I remember scenes that talked about interracial relationships when I wasn't seeing that in other shows on network television. I was also a super sheltered kid. I didn't watch a lot of TV growing up. And so as far as the silo that I was raised in, that, you know, maybe that's way off, but that's where I was coming from. And I will, the one thing I will add is I watched the show because a very close friend of mine, who's been a very close friend of mine for over two decades, also watches the show. And I remember one of the first times he saw it, he said, "My mama's on TV. You know, this is like I'm watching something where I see my family in this."
I know, Brian, what do you, I'll just let you react to that however you want to.
Yeah, I mean, I do think like Roseanne's quote in the New York Post article, yeah, that showed up where she said, you know, "I'm the same, you all have moved," is the one that really hits me. You know, that I think that in its original run, it wasn't partisan because we weren't as partisan. You know, at the same time, there was also this sense of, like, I mean, growing up in upstate New York, there was always this sense of being just kind of forgotten by everything. You know, and that's you know, there's a way that there's a very long conversation to be had about how Appalachia extends from Georgia all the way up to the Canadian border. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there was definitely a sense of it all being left behind, including, as long as we're on this, when Clinton was senator. I mean, she was basically senator of New York City. Mm-hmm. And there was always this sense of, like, she didn't care about the rest of the state. And her campaign reflected that, you know, that she was not somebody who was good at connecting with, you know, people outside of cities. And so to the extent that the Roseanne thing matters now, it's pretty cool, because I think it's a great litmus test for how much things have changed, that now we can't just watch the show as an interesting show about a working class white family. We also now have to talk about it in terms of our presidential politics, right, which really wasn't part of the equation back then, and most definitely is now. I mean, there's a really interesting way that Roseanne, as we talk about people being ahead of her time, like, she's way ahead in that sense.
Right. And there's, I mean, it's worth noting there are some maybe sharp divides between Roseanne Conner and Roseanne Barr. Roseanne Barr's Twitter feed is frequently kind of offensively Trumpian,
right. Yep.
And trades in some of the really kind of disturbing kinds of
for
memes.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
I think somebody was pointing out on Point today that there was I was just checking the feed to see if I could find it, that there was, you know, David Hogg is Hitler or something. You know, there's sort of the kinds of things that come trickling out of the Twitter feeds of truly reprehensible people are on her Twitter feed. But that gets back to the question, though, you know, the art and the artist. If she can create the show that's sort of a crucible for looking at some of these questions, then maybe we have something.
Well, I mean, I think so. There's an interesting juxtaposition here, and I'll kind of pull it back to an artist that we talked about in the first segment briefly, Bill Cosby, right? So Roseanne came out, the season that Roseanne came out, the Cosby Show was in its like prime and was a great show. I mean, right, we're talking about a show about an upper middle class black educated family, and then Roseanne comes out to be the almost like the antithesis of that exact thing. And so when we're talking about, right, separating the art from the artists, right? I think I'm sort of struggling with the same thing from with Roseanne as I was or and am with Bill Cosby. But Roseanne, I think, doesn't ask you to separate her art from her, right? Like she doesn't. That's fair. She doesn't ask you to do that, right? I think in some of her interviews, she's very clear that, right, she wants the writers to be as true to life as possible. It is a show named after the artist, right, in the same way that The Cosby Show was named after Bill Cosby, right, like, even though the name of the family in it was the Huxtables. So it feels like there is a, I don't know, there's this divide in who's sort of watching, and I think, Lucy, this is a little bit to your point, there's a divide in who's watching the Roseanne, and I can't even say the original because this is really just like a reboot. This is like a continuation. This is season 10, right? There's a divide in the folks who are watching Roseanne and the folks who are not watching Roseanne, and I think it's the same divide that that happened when it first came out in, what was that, 88? But I also feel as though, right, so half of all of my in-laws are in Washington, Colorado, Wyoming, and Montana, and they represent, right, the Roseanne family, right? Their names might as well be Connor. And I think what is interesting about rebooting a show like this in 2018 as opposed to when it came out, 30 years ago at this point, is TV right now is really smart and not for... or seemingly not for folks who don't feel like they belong to the educated class, don't feel like they belong to the upper middle class. So I think it's a great way to kind of engage an entire group of folks who may feel like TV's not for them today.
Well, I think also, Lucy, and you were alluding to this, and I think in your earlier comments, there's a conversation we need to have as a nation that we don't know how to have.
No.
You know, we're really heavily divided. I've been dealing with this on social media this week where, you know, when I take a backseat to nobody in demonizing Donald Trump, but I'm less comfortable blanketly demonizing all of his voters.
Mm-hmm. I'm actually super uncomfortable doing that.
Yeah. And so I was saying to people this week on Facebook, there's 63 million of them. Now, like even Hillary Clinton said half of them were a basket of deplorables and the other half were people searching for answers, searching for change, right, and not necessarily subscribing to the most disgusting premises of the Trump campaign. I mean, that was, people forget that was the point of that basket of deplorables speech. Half of them, nasty Islamophobic, transphobic, everything phobic. The other half, just, you know, regular Americans, maybe not unlike some of the people you see on Roseanne. So I don't know if we can all watch Roseanne together, like 36 million of us, and then have a conversation about all that stuff. That would be great.
I mean, I'm down. I think you're right. We're talking. We do a lot of talking past each other.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think that's absolutely right. I think also just not saying things like, oh, those people were voting against their best interest, because immediately you've alienated
that's
someone
like
by
ridiculous.
The time.
Yeah, yeah. That is the most ridiculous comment.
But the number of women, and I will say middle upper class white women I've heard say, and I quote, women who voted for Donald Trump were engaging in self-harm, or they were not voting in their best self-interest. Well, that, I mean, conversation over, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so you need to, I think that maybe in some universe, this show could open up a conversation. I like talking to people in the Rust Belt who voted for Donald Trump because they feel very disenfranchised, and finding out what their issues are. And listening to them, not with a preconceived set of notions. Do I agree with them? Usually, no, probably never. But I think we can definitely learn something. There's something there.
Certainly with one black character, they're already more diverse than Friends. All right, we have to take a break so we'll have time to talk about Death of Stalin. We'll do that. Indeed, we are back. This is The Nose, and we are lucky to have here Lucy Gelman, Mercy Quay, and Brian Slattery. We went to the movies this week. We went to see The Death of Stalin. It is both a comedy and not a comedy. Characters who include Michael Palin as Molotov, Steve Buscemi as Khrushchev, Jeffrey Tambor as Malenkov, have arguments about who did what. Everybody is very suspicious of everybody else, and everybody is very eager to. Oh, I just got told that I mispronounced. It's Buscemi. I never knew that. Everybody is eager to blame everybody else, very much in the style of all Armando Iannucci comedies, but darker, darker, darker. Here's a little clip where some of the people I just mentioned are trying to essentially blame one another.
Sneeze on the bastards as they go past.
Did you invite them?
No.
Ask Beria if he invited the bishops.
Don't give me orders. Ask Beria if he invited the bishops.
Did you invite the bishops?
Yes.
Yes. Well?
He said yes.
I'm going to give everyone in Red Square a voucher permitting one kick each to his stupid face.
Is he asking for some delicious hay?
No, he said something quite complicated about a voucher system.
Ask Nikita. Why in God's ass he invited the bishops?
No, I've already explained why.
You tell him. Never mind.
All right, so we're back. This is, I think, during the funeral itself, and everybody is kind of playing a game of telephone where they're kind of getting the messages a little bit wrong. Brian Slattery, I'll start with you. how did this movie land for you?
So there needs to be a little preface here, which is that at one point I had this job for 3.5 years where I worked at a social science research foundation and read for 3.5 years just about violence and about the awful things that people have done to each other through the centuries and across the world. So it had a lot of stuff about Soviet Russia. Mm-hmm. So this movie, kind of like the way touring musicians think Spinal Tap is more like a documentary than a satire, mm-hmm. I watched this movie feeling like this movie was very accurate. I didn't laugh as much as people in the audience mm-hmm. did, but this was partially because the absurdity in it felt real.
Right, like, which is the curse of Armando Iannucci. Anyway.
Yeah, yeah. I liked the movie. Mm. I liked it a lot, actually. And then, like, there are parts of it that I thought were really good at getting at some very like subtle points about what happens when a sort of totalitarian regime mm-hmm. collapses and there's this kind of crazy struggle for power and no mechanisms in place to deal with it. Like the scenes that are sticking with me are actually some of the minor ones. Like there's one where shortly after his death and shortly after the officials leave his house, spoiler alert, Stalin dies in this movie. The soldiers immediately ransack the place. Yeah. Like they're taking advantage of it. And not only do they do that, but they start killing each other.
Right.
Which is well, accurate. I mean, I can imagine there are people who would find that kind of shocking, that they would suddenly turn on each other or whatever it is. But there's this one scene where these two guards are sitting in the road watching a truck pull away, and one just turns to the other and shoots him in the head. Right. And I was like, that is a very real moment in this movie. And I appreciate is a weird word to describe that mm-hmm. scene, but like I really did appreciate how it felt like people had done their research.
Yes,
it was great.
I was very struck by that exact thing that you describe. Yeah. And the people, the truck is pulling away, so the two men standing in the road are getting very small, and suddenly one of them takes out a pistol and shoots the other one in the head. You don't even know who these characters are. If there's the right. violence equivalent of a throwaway line, a throwaway yes. joke, mm-hmm. this is a throwaway.
And the way they handled violence, they handled violence on that sort of, it wasn't glorified, it wasn't moralized, it wasn't anything, it was just shown. I thought, this is really pretty remarkable.
It's kind of background violence, right, Lucy? There's like one moment where a body just comes bumping down the stairs. I mean, it doesn't. Right. It's like in this back of the frame, you know. I mean, there's sort of this sense that Well, Iannucci has said that he actually dialed down some of the historical detail because it was too absurd, that he was trying to
That's
make an absurdist
so
movie.
Believable.
Yeah. He was trying to make an absurdist movie, but not that absurd.
Right.
He had to, yeah. Anyway, right. I don't know. How did this work for you?
No, I completely agree with Brian. We saw it at the same time, and there were people in the theater who were howling. Mm-hmm. I mean, actually, just literally howling. And I didn't find myself doing that, but I found myself laughing and checking myself and laughing and checking myself, because that's where the magic of the movie comes mm-hmm. in. You realize that this violence is so absurd and yet so spot on. And it's, yep. you know, yes, it's about a specific moment, but it's also about what we inflict on each other. And sort of it, I think it felt timely, even though I know that it came out much earlier in the UK, right?
Yes, it did in yes. October of 17.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh.
Yes, but it does feel like Trump's White House, where everybody's
so.
Sort of scrambling around. I mean, it is mostly a story about a mad scramble for power right after the
yes.
death of Stalin. Who's going to come out on top? Alliances are formed and then deformed in favor of other alliances.
Well, it also feels like you could have made this movie about Iraq. You could have made it about
yeah.
right.
Congo in the mm-hmm. 60s. You could have made it about like any number of regimes, you know, where this sort of thing happens, where there's some guy at the top who's calling all the shots in a really arbitrary and deeply personal way, and then as soon as he's gone, you go, what do you do?
And yeah, I also think that it needed to be Stalin, right? Mm.
He's the example.
Exactly.
For having survived as long as he did.
And for the moment that we're in, right?
Yeah.
The power struggle we're in right now with Russia, it needed to be Stalin in order for it to be as impactful as it was. I think my experience in the theater was very different than yours. Mm. Maybe it was because I saw a matinee. I don't know. Everyone was very just quiet and observant. And I was just like, this is hilarious. People laugh.
Yeah.
And you know, I'm like, it's a riot. I'm in the background tossing up my popcorn. It was a hoot to me. And I think so. One of my for no particular reason, one of my favorite actors is Rupert Friend,
mm-hmm.
Who plays Peter something or another.
Quinn,
yes, in
Homeland.
In Homeland, who's one of my favorite characters on TV. And I actually think that Peter Quinn's character, right, that character,
mm-hmm. he plays Vasily Stalin, the
son of
wastrel
Stalin.
Son.
Exactly.
Vasily, right?
I think it ends up. I think
he definitely had a way of stealing some scenes.
Yeah. Oh yeah, exactly.
For sure.
Yeah, and yeah. one of the most absurd yeah. scenes that I think I stole the show in the theater was that struggle for the gun.
Mm-hmm.
During Stalin's
Amazing.
Autopsy.
Yes.
It was so well done. And just
again,
like,
so real.
Yes.
It's the whole, like, who wants to interfere with Stalin's son? Because
exactly.
there's still that residual thing of, like, well, Stalin's going to kill us if
yep.
we interfere with his
right.
son.
Even though his head is open
it
on the table.
It doesn't matter. It
right.
doesn't matter. Those
and
old,
and
those
that's
old
a Lucy
hard.
Moment, too, that as you're watching it, you're laughing, checking yourself. Because
right.
something
yeah.
really horrible could be about to happen
yes.
right before
I
your
mean,
eyes.
I mean, even the there's this scene before that. So before Stalin goes totally kaput, where he is like gesturing and kind of garbling his sentences, and the question is he trying to name a successor? And you're going around the foot of the
yes.
bed, and it's like, is it the little old maid? Is it? And it could be anyone.
And the
it
realization that it really could have been anybody,
right?
Like, that's how
yeah.
personalistic the regime was.
I mean, and also that, like, he set up an entire regime that made people so afraid of him that
yeah.
it led to, in a
right.
really, like, in a real way, it led to his death. No doctor would perform anything on him, right? All the doctors were either
right.
in the gulag or in jail or dead.
Yeah, if you've ever worked in any kind of organization where the person at the top ruled by fear, which happens in corporate America,
for
I've
sure.
been in these organizations,
yeah.
you wind up with a workforce that doesn't know what to do. The
yeah.
only thing that they know is that if they do something wrong, they'll be punished.
They're out. Right.
And so they can't make decisions. They can't even make the most tiny little everyday decisions.
Well, and you see that, you know, long after Stalin's death, which is sort of comes at the beginning of the movie, you see that because they've all been so reined by fear,
mm-hmm.
even though they're close to the top, that they keep referencing, you know, well, what it's like WWSD, what would
yeah.
Stalin do?
Mm-hmm.
And
it's so funny that the original letter in that acronym is J.
Right.
and
for Jesus.
Yeah, yeah. Yes. Who has a very significant
day on Sunday.
Well,
he should have copyrighted it then.
Yeah, jeez. What was he thinking?
What was he? Yeah.
Yeah. But it is like, even as they are becoming, you know, ever more divisive, they have these moments where they stop and they say like, oh, but Comrade Stalin. Mm-hmm. And it's, I mean, it's funny because Colin, I think you're right. You know, that divisiveness and fear happens in the nonprofit sector too, all the time.
Yeah.
And I've worked at one of those places, and it's like you don't know what to do, and you're so ill-equipped for any sort of change. You know, and jokingly, I've been in a place where you call it a regime change, but it is.
Well, except that those, like, the people at the top are definitely equipped for change. Like, they've been stewing on these ideas for years. And now,
but everyone out on the bottom,
and they're all taking their shots.
Completely,
you know?
Disabled to make any decision.
Right.
I do want to revisit the point you made earlier, Colin, about the passing delivery of violence here. Even like the fatal shot to the movie. Mm. And I mean, yeah, this is history. But even the fatal shot to the movie was done so quickly, mm-hmm. that, yep. you're like, that's the crescendo, right? That's it, and it is
what makes you realize how much so movies good. Telegraph their punches, and how, yeah. much they tell you what to, yeah. think, and all of that stuff that I deeply resent most of the time, and right. wasn't in this movie. I mean,
we're gonna have to break here. I do want to say, Iannucci's that, I think one of the things he does, he breaks all of the rules, mm-hmm. Of character and narrative and delivery of scenes, but because yes, the critical moments are delivered as afterthoughts. He also creates ensemble cast invariably, whether it's Veep or In the Loop or this movie, of completely unsympathetic characters. Usually you have to have Mary Tyler Moore or Judd Hirsch or, you know, somebody. somebody, yes, in whom you
what
can
a
impress,
cast.
You
what
know?
A cast in this
movie. This has a tremendous cast, but everybody is either spineless or disgusting or violent or usually all three. Anyway, we have to take a quick break, so we'll have time to make some recommendations. We'll do that.
Today's show was produced by Jonathan McPants, with help from me, Kyone Wolfe, Betsy Kaplan, and Joe Koss. The part of Bill Curry was played by Sting. On Monday, we'll be back with news from over the weekend on The Scramble. And now, back to Colin.
We're back here doing the news in New Haven with Lucy Gelman, editor of the arts paper, host of WNHH Radio's Kitchen Sink, Brian Slattery, arts editor for the New Haven Independent and a producer at WNHH Radio. So when they say that they know what it's like to work under a soulless tyrant, obviously they're talking about Paul Bass.
No.
And another one, yes. So Mercy Quay is a founder and executive director of the Narrative Project. They're all here with us. They're going to make some recommendations now. And so, Brian, why don't you go first?
This is a bizarre recommendation, but I've been playing this game with people for the last couple of, it's been like a month now. I was going to say a couple of weeks, but it's been a month. The game is, think of a four-run stretch that somebody has done, like a band. Their four best albums that they did in a row.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That they did in a row.
I think I played this game.
For a director,
did I play this game on your
Possibly.
Your
the four best movies that they did in a row. Now, what's really fun about this game is that you both get to revisit things that you like from the past, but in a very different way of sort of being like, but did they have a streak like that, or did they just make a couple of good albums, mm-hmm. or a couple of good movies, or a couple of good books or whatever? And then the other part of the game that's fun is to say, like, who is on deck to be doing your next four album streak. Mm.
Did you invent this game?
No. I should credit Donald Brown, because we got together at one point.
But
and
it's
we
a
started,
New Haven indigenous game.
I have no idea.
Which you play with sticks and beads.
Yes. Yes.
The
sticks and beads
indigenous
and,
people
and,
of New Haven.
Bottle so caps it, of Fox and Park.
Well, I played it somewhere. I guess probably on your Facebook page, and
it's
loads
been,
of fun.
It's been super fun, and it's like, it makes you think.
In a headachey way, it's fun.
Yeah, it ended up meaning that I pulled up Wikipedia constantly in like a four-hour conversation right. about like, okay, who's the next one we can do?
Right.
If you, and so if, it's really fun.
If you haven't experienced real fun, then this is fun. But
yeah,
if you, like, you know,
that's
if
right.
you ever had any real fun,
yes.
then this is going to be kind of a little bit. But I did enjoy playing it.
Yes.
That's a great recommendation.
Yeah.
Lucy, what have you got for us?
Okay, I have two quick ones. So the first one, the last time my partner was on WNPR, he endorsed me. I'm going to do the second
Aww.
Best thing, which is that I am, so every year on Easter, I bake for his family. This year, Easter and Passover are the same weekend, which is either wonderful or horrible, however you want to look at it. So I am making like 50,000 macaroons this weekend, and I highly recommend this recipe by Deb Burl. Perlman of Smitten Kitchen. They're raspberry macaroons. You cannot mess them up. They're wonderful. They're great for Easter. They're great for Passover. And I love you, Tom, if you're listening to this right now. And the other is a new album that's out from An Historic, which is the moniker for Adam Matlock. He's a New Haven artist. It's an Brian, I would say, somewhat experimental accordion album called Something We Could Never Live Without.
Yeah.
It's beautiful. It is lovely. I've probably listened to it six
and who's
or seven
the artist
times.
Again? Say the name.
It's An Historic or Adam Matlock. And it is so, so lovely. You can find him on Bandcamp under An Historic. Support an independent artist. You can download it for $5. It is a really, really good investment.
Well, you know, we're not a very accordion-friendly show. We did our accordion episode last week. Yeah. All right. So, Mercy, what have you got?
Okay. So, I had three, and then Brian gave me the game, and so now I have four.
Yes.
And because of that,
playing right now.
So, first answer is Beyonce. Second answer is Kendrick. And so I'm endorsing both of those in one endorsement. That is my fourth. now, starting back from the top, two books and a podcast. If you haven't downloaded it on Audible yet, please do so. Trevor Noah's book, Born a Crime, narrated by him. It's an amazing tale of his life. Additionally, because I am a space nerd, Astrophysics for People in a Hurry by Neil deGrasse Tyson, a man I have never met but continuously call my father. If you meet him, don't tell him I call him my father. And if you meet my father, don't tell him I call Neil deGrasse Tyson my father.
In fact, forget you heard this radio show.
Exactly. Yeah. That's not an endorsement at all. My podcast endorsement is Star Talk, which is Neil deGrasse Tyson's podcast with Chuck Nice. It's hilarious. It is approachable, and it is, I think, authentically two things. It is authentically science, and it is authentically Black, which usually don't share space in the same intersection. So I would definitely suggest you check that out.
So I'm always like looking for a way to reload myself with endorsements because I have to do them every week. But so last week I didn't have to do any endorsements. I was in New York City. I saw four plays, watched one movie, and read a novel. So I feel like I'm just teeming with things that I could conceivably endorse. I am going to first of all endorse the novel. It's called A History of Wolves. The History of Wolves by Emily Fridland. It is a novel that takes place in the upper parts of Minnesota. I don't even know how to describe it other than the narrator is kind of scout from To Kill a Mockingbird, but like tougher, grittier, and maybe been through a lot worse things than Scout. I don't want to say too much about it. I don't have time really to read very many novels for pleasure, not as many as I used to, because I'm constantly getting ready for this show, which has kind of turned me into a moron. So it was a thrill to read this, and it was a thrill to read such a good novel, too. I was very hungry for something like that. So The History of Wolves, Emily Fridland, I'm almost promising you that if you pick it up, you will find it hard to put down. I'm going to endorse one of the plays that I saw, too. It's playing at the Public Theater, which is a good place to see a play because it's less expensive, and at least one of those plays turned into Hamilton eventually. This one is also set in the 18th century. It's called The Low Road. It's written by the same playwright who wrote Clybourne Park. It is based, oddly enough, on the theories of Adam Smith. Adam Smith is a character in the play who speaks only to the audience. So there's somebody as Adam Smith talking to the audience all the time. And then there's this protagonist who has basically embraced Adam Smith's ideas, which are basically to pursue money and benefit for yourself is all you need to do, that an invisible hand will guide everything to its proper destiny if everybody just sort of goes after what they want with minimal interference. He, therefore, is kind of a reprehensible character. He's a perfect Armando Iannucci character. And the play, it's really marvelously staged and really interesting, and also was written, according to the playwright, more as a commentary on the 2008 economic meltdown, set, as I say, in the 18th century. But it works pretty well today, too. It seems to have an awful lot of things to say. So it's very, very postmodern, very fun. If you can get into New York, it's at the Public Theater. It is called The Low Road. All right. I want to thank everybody who helped out today, especially Jonathan McNichol and Betsy Kaplan's down here, too, in our Gateway Community College studios, which had to be opened opened up just for us because Gateway Community College is closed because it's Good Friday. Thanks very much to the wonderful panel, Mercy Quay and Lucy Gelman. And Brian Slattery will be back on Monday with a scramble. Plenty to talk about.
As a matter of fact, oh yeah. Talk about Torrington, Vernon, Danbury, Waterbury, Oliveberry, Woodbury, hitting on New Britain, Vernon, I already said that one, Avon, Farmington, yeah, 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 yeah.